South Carolina.
My name's Tom Brady, Jr. I'm an alcoholic. Saw a couple of guys I'd seen down at the Brazos conference back in November, and they asked me where the hen was. That's what I call my wife, the old hen. You got to know she calls me the turkey. I haven't had a drink since July 20th of 1965, and that is strong evidence of God's grace. Don't know if you've ever thought about grace. Grace is that powerful force that originates outside of our consciousness, which works constantly for our good. And I've begun to be a watcher for things that happen in my life every day for my good that I don't have anything to do with. You know, and the great spiritual teachers of all time have told us we should watch. We even belong to a program that speaks of being awake. I invite you to watch. It's quite an experience. This is an exciting place that we exist in, and God knows I almost missed it. I want you to know, too, I'm not from Greensboro, North Carolina. I'm from Dobson, North Carolina, which happens to be, in case you didn't know, the cultural capital of the universe. We have a beautiful courthouse, and the big cultural event of the year takes place along about in July. We begin today with the Dobson Philharmonic Orchestra, which consists of a harmonica player and a banjo player. And then we have the annual tractor pull. That's the big cultural event of the season. And we love it up there. Everybody's happy. It's quiet. It's a farming community. It's a beautiful place in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And I love it. I have before me here a blue book that says Alcoholics Anonymous. Ain't that something? I wonder why they put it here. And you know, within that book is a prescription for recovery from alcoholism that is unparalleled in the history of mankind. It's a guaranteed system of recovery. It's a toolkit, this book is. And all we have to do if we want to be sober people is open up the kit of spiritual tools and pull out the tools, and don't do like so many of us do, as I'll tell you later, and try to use those tools according to your own directions. They also give directions in the toolkit. And there's a place in this book that says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It's a guaranteed program of recovery, life, hope, happiness. And the book says in another place, one of my favorite lines, something about the God that I understand that I'll talk something about tonight. It says, we are sure that God wants us to be happy and joyous and free. And it says somewhere else in this book that our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those about us. How many of us, if we had known that when we got here, would have stayed? And it's through this program that I'm coming upon the meaning of my life. And it's only through this program that I've come upon the meaning of my life. And it's quite simple. I'm here to learn and to love and to serve. Those three things. And it is a gas. I'm having a ball. Now, I'm a Baptist as well as an alcoholic. I got to warn you about that. Okay? I used to say rather facetiously that I suffered from two incurable diseases, baptism and alcoholism. And by the grace of God, I was recovering from both. So I may preach to you a little bit tonight, and I'm making no apologies for it. I've come to the point where I'm a lot like old Popeye. I am what I am, and that's all that I am. And that's a good place to be, because that means no phony, no bullshit. Just be Tom. And I kind of like Tom now. And I used to hate him. And that's quite a change. But I got to tell you Jesus' story, being a Baptist, okay? Since Jesus came back to earth, and he had a longing to see his earthly father. And he's walking down the streets, and he sees this little man, and this little man's obviously looking for somebody, too. And he said, tell me, who are you looking for? He said, I'm looking for my father. He said, he wasn't my real father. He's kind of like my earthly father, but he took care of me while I was down here. And the little man said, that's funny. He said, I'm looking for my son. He said, he wasn't exactly my son. He was more like, you know, my earthly son, and I took care of him for a while. And Jesus looked at the man, and he said, well, he was a carpenter. And the little man says, I'm a carpenter, too. And Jesus, getting more excited, and said, well, his name was Joseph. And the little man said, my name is Joseph. And Jesus reached out for him and said, Father. And the little man reached out and said, Pinocchio. No Another one that says Jesus was walking down the street one day and he saw this mob, you know. He ran up there to see what was going on, and they were all gathered around this poor guy, and they had him tied to a post in the middle of a circle, and they was getting ready to stone him. And Jesus ran in there and said, "Stop! Let anyone who's without sin cast the first stone." And this sweet-looking little old lady came through there and picked up a big rock and hit that sucker side of the head. And Jesus said, "Mama, what'd you do that for?" I'm not going to talk to you much about drinking tonight. Come to the point in my sobriety where I think that drinking is really a symptom of alcoholism. Maybe one of the smallest symptoms of alcoholism. And I think that we spend too much time talking about drinking, and I think a lot of alcoholics don't get sober because they can't match drinking patterns with some of us. You know, we're all different. We're individual. We're unique. Every one of us. And yet we're the same. I can go down to your local Skid Row, and it wouldn't take me long to find it. I had a propensity for finding places like that. And I can lift a man's head up out of the gutter, you know, and ask him certain questions about his feelings and his attitudes and his thoughts and his inside self. And I can go out to the biggest mansion in this town, and an alcoholic housewife sitting in there, and ask her the same questions. And guess what? If she's an alcoholic, she'll give the same answers. Alcoholism to me has very little to do with age and sex and race and creed and religion and social standing, the amount of money you have, how much education you have. Alcoholism is alcoholism like a rose is a rose. And no matter how different we are on the outside, inside, our alcoholism is the same. Mine is yours and yours is mine. That's the reason one simple 12-step program works for all of us. That's the reason the book says that we're people who normally would not mix. But we have a common problem to which we found the common solution. And one of the biggest lies I told myself for so many years was, "I'm different. I'm not like that." I'd hear a speaker, and I'd pick out the things that I hadn't done, and then I could say, "Well, I haven't done those things, therefore I'm not an alcoholic." So I'm going to talk about my feelings, folks, and my insides. What people call character. That set of inside traits that make me what I am, that cause all my behavior, including my drinking. Character. Combination of values and beliefs and feelings and perceptions. I'm going to talk about my soul. I'm going to take you on a trip inside of me, and I'm going to talk about my life and my death and my rebirth and my regeneration, because that's what this program is all about. You see, I died. I died July 20th, 1965. And whatever your sobriety date is, the old self that was in you began to die that day too. And it's like one philosopher said, "My friends, all through life we must continue to learn how to live. But what may surprise you is that all through life we also have to continue to learn how to die." I have found in this program there are bottoms beyond bottoms and surrenders beyond surrenders. And every one of them opens up a new door to something more fascinating, to something more real, and yes, painful, many times. And I found too that without pain, I just don't grow much. I'm a hard-headed alcoholic. And when I hurt, I move. And when I have deadlines to meet, I meet them. So I'm going to talk to you about those things. And please forget who you are for a while, and think about what you are. Try to identify with what I'm talking about in terms of feelings and attitudes. Quit telling yourself because you're 18 years old or 23 years old or 30 years old, you're different. Like a friend of mine in North Carolina says, "If you waddle like a duck and you quack like a duck, you're a duck." Now let's get into it. I'm an idealist. I was born into this world knowing how this world ought to be. Nobody had to teach me that. I knew how the world ought to be, and I knew how the other people in it ought to be, and I knew how I ought to be. And I looked at the world, and it wasn't. And I looked at you, and you weren't. And I looked at me, and I wasn't either. I spent 30 years of my life trying so hard to be what I thought I ought to be, I didn't have time to be. I had images built for me from childhood days. I was raised in a time when little boys were little men. They were even called little men. And I was told, Tommy, little men aren't afraid, and little men don't cry, and little men don't do bad things. I had some problems with that. And when I feel fear, and they say, Tommy, are you afraid? I'd say, no. And when I was crying, are you crying? No. And did you do that? No. I started lying shortly after I started talking. That's what I'm getting at. Okay? Seemed like the thing to do. To live up to that image that I had for myself and that other people who were important to me had for me. That's what you do, I thought. And I'm a perfectionist. Not was, folks. Am. Always was, always will be. I'm one of those people who likes to have everything just right, just the way it's supposed to be at any given time. And I meet alcoholics who think they're not perfectionists. I could prove that you are. I could hang a picture on the wall over there crooked and time you alcoholics on my watch. And you'd have to go straighten up that picture. And then somebody would say, it's high on the left. Somebody would say, no, it ain't. It's high on the right. And then the Al-Anons would get into it. Okay? You got to know I am a sometimes victim of Al-Anon brutality also. And the world wasn't what it ought to be. And I knew that. I mean, I knew it. Not here, here. And I wanted to make it perfect. And everything I did in my life, I did better and quicker than anybody else had ever done it. I had to have the spotlight, number one place, never number two, never number three. Always headed for the top. I was the teacher's pet. I was the soloist in the choir. I played the cornet solo. Look at these lips. They ain't cornet lips. I was the one who borrowed a bass fiddle from the high school band director, practiced 2 weeks like to drove my mom and daddy crazy. And when I was 17 years old, 2 weeks later, I was playing with one of the best college dance bands in the state of North Carolina. I'm talking perfection. But there's a problem with that. You see, we perfectionists, in my own mind, if I wasn't the best, I was automatically the worst. See, there are two ends of perfection, like there are two ends of pride. One end of pride is I love myself too much. The other end, and most of us suffer from this, we hate ourselves too much, but both are pride. And being the best or the worst, it's both perfection. And that's the way I was. And I'm a sensitive human being. Alcoholics are sensitive people. We got feelings, folks. I walked around with mine sticking out 50 yards in all directions. And God help you if you stepped on them. The funny thing about me was, if nobody stepped on them, I'd go find somebody to hurt my feelings. Seemed like I felt I deserved getting my feelings hurt, you know? I'd cry at the drop of a pin. You know, I can see a pretty flower, a picture, hear a piece of music, and I cry like a baby. Break out in chill bumps all over. I couldn't stand praise, and I couldn't stand criticism. If you praised me, you didn't praise me enough. If you criticized me, you had gone too far. And God, I'm a romantic. I loved atmosphere, music. I sold a long time before I found out atmosphere wasn't a damn thing, but a dirty place with very few lights in it. And I'm also one of those guys that has always believed that a tree just ain't the prettiest thing that God ever made. I think women are. And I love them. I love beautiful women and attractive women, mediocre women, ugly women. I have woke up with women who looked like they'd been dead a year. But you know, the night before and all that atmosphere, she was one of God's lovely creatures. And I'd wake up and have two reasons to puke. And I was always dreaming. Always dreaming. Every drunk's got a piece of music. Every one of us got a piece of music. Old sad blues, country and western. Going down to the river, going to jump in the river and drown. Yeah. You ought to heard mine. My piece of music was a thing by the Four Freshmen. Saddest damn song you ever heard. Called Their Hearts Were Full of Spring. You want to hear it? I'll give you a little bit of it. This is a drunk song par excellence, okay? There's a story told of a very special boy and the girl who wore his ring. Through the wintry snows, their love remained still warm, for their hearts were full of spring. Ain't that pretty? But that ain't the worst part. The chorus was a killer. The chorus said, then one day they died, and their graves were side by side, on a hill where robins sing. And they say violets grow there the whole year round, for their hearts were full of spring. And God, I used to play that record, you know, before it got done, before this day of good, I done started it over again. I was 9 years sober, and I found that record, and I pulled it out and started to listen to it, and my wife liked to went into hysterics. Don't play it! Don't play it! And I was always dreaming, you know. Couldn't stand reality like it was. So I made my own. I'd sit around and wish. Any of y'all sit around and wish? Wish I was somebody else, living somewhere else, doing something else with somebody else. Tremendous sense of dissatisfaction and emptiness inside of me. Never being satisfied with myself at all. And I sit there and dream. Why couldn't I be Sir Galahad? Have me a white horse and a lance and a maiden put a handkerchief on it. God, that'd tear me up. And run out and kill them damn dragons. Why couldn't I go in a quest after the Holy Grail, you know? I forget they didn't even have indoor plumbing in them days. And I know what I'd have done when I seen a dragon. Then there's one time I found out through research. We drunks are great researchers. Through research that all the great gunfighters in the West did not have black hair and black mustaches. Did you know, and y'all are from the West, most of the great killers in the West were blondes with blue eyes. Look at me. And I think, why couldn't I be John Wesley Hardy? Yeah. He changed reality. If he didn't like it, he blew it away. And I spent a lot of time dreaming in dreamland. My sexual fantasies I could write a 4-volume book about. I ain't gonna get into that. I heard a story a long time ago, Bill. Old Jacko told a story about dreaming. I've always loved it. There were two winos under a bridge and said they shook two. Now he said, winos don't wake up, they shake two. And these two winos shook too, and one of them said to the other, man, I had the best dream I ever had in my life last night. And he said, well, what did you dream? He said, I dreamed my mama called me home and gave me $25 and told me to go spend the whole day at Disneyland. He said, did you go? He said, yeah. Had a good time. So I rode all the rides and saw all the dancing girls, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Goofy. Had a wonderful time. The other old drunk punched him and said, that ain't nothing. I had a better dream than that. He said, oh, yes, sir, what'd you dream? He said, man, I dreamed I had me a luxury apartment, two cases of Jack Daniels. They'd come and knock on my door, and it opened the most beautiful blonde and redhead you ever saw in your life, came through the door and started taking their clothes off. And the other old drunk was caught up in the story. He said, why didn't you call me? He said, I did, but your mama said you was at Disneyland. Always dreaming. Always seeking approval from the outside. Strokes. You know, when you hate your own guts, you do that. Or I should say, you overdo that. Now, I'm an idealist living in a non-ideal world, a perfectionist living in imperfection, a very sensitive human being, a romantic, and the world is not a dreamland. And my overriding feeling from the time I was a little boy, I can put a four-letter word on. Fear. From my earliest memories, I was afraid. I read a book by a psychologist once, and he listed 206 different fears. You better believe I'd had them all. But there was fear number 207. What Bill Wilson called the fear of impending calamity. Impending doom. And with me, it went like this. Oh, my God, I don't know what's going to happen to me, and I don't know who's going to do it and where it's going to happen and why or when. But something's going to happen to me, and it's going to be bad. The shrinks call that free-floating anxiety. Mine didn't float. I like what the teenagers call it. They say, man, look at him. He's wired. And I want you to know I had a lot to be afraid about, too. I was the ugliest baby you ever saw. My own mama told me that. She said, son, you're so ugly, I didn't take you out of the house for 6 weeks you was on Earth. I didn't want people to see you. And I told the psychiatrist about that once. He said, goodness, that must have been traumatic for you. I said, no, sir, I've seen my baby pictures. And I was ugly. And as I got to growing, things didn't get much better. See, I wanted to be manly. I wanted to be a macho man. My dad had four big macho brothers, and my mother had four of the biggest, meanest brothers you ever saw, and the biggest, meanest one in the bunch was my Uncle Bud. He was macho, and I wanted to be like Uncle Bud. Uncle Bud was a motorcycle cop in the days when they wore riding breeches and them leather spats up to their knees. You remember? Some of you do, and some of you won't admit it. And he had a harness across here with silver bullets in it and a pearl handle 38 on his hip. And he squeaked when he walked. And it smelled like gunpowder and shaving lotion. God damn it, that's macho. And I wanted to be like him. You know what happened to me? As I was growing up, I grew this great shock of snow white hair. Not blonde, not gold, snow white hair. And you know what my macho uncles call me? Pudding head. You know, it's hard to be macho when people call you pudding head. Even when I was 18, my nickname was Sweet Lips. And I didn't like that. And I was skinny. I'm so skinny when I turn sideways, I look a lot like a tricycle ready to go. And I became aware that my mother hated me. In my old mind, she did, because she made me wear knickers. Here we all have to wear knickers. Always brown corduroy knickers. And my leg is that big and the knicker hole is that big. And I forever walk around pulling up them knickers, you know. Trying to be macho and fishing every step I walk. And I'd hide them and throw them away. And there's another man in that town, that little mill town where I was born, hated me. Name was Steinberg. He ran the only department store. And him and my mama had a plot against me. They kept a supply of brown corduroy knickers. And when I'd lose a pair of them, there's always another one to take their place. I didn't wear long pants, folks, till I was 14 years old. It was either short pants or knickers. Okay? Now, you think that's enough? Skinny pudding head. That ain't all. I had freckles. I had freckles from the top of my head to the soles of my feet. I had freckles where people ain't supposed to have freckles. And I hated them. And when I looked at me, I saw something that was ugly. I didn't like me. And I'm going to tell you a secret. If you look at yourself and you see something ugly, that's what you are. If you look at the world and you see it as ugly, that's what it is. If you look at people and see them as enemies, that's what they are. Have you ever stopped to realize that each of us has the power to create our own reality by the way that we look at it? Have you ever stopped to realize that we behave in terms of the way that we see things, not the way things really are? If I want this to be a good world, I got to see a good world when I look at it. But I didn't know that then. I didn't like me. I was ugly. And I used to figure to myself, well, if I can ever get rid of these freckles, that's the thing. They're outstandingly ugly. If I can ever get rid of them, I'm going to be okay. And you know what I did long about the age of 12 or 13? They're replaced with the most beautiful set of pimples you ever saw in your life. And I just didn't have pimples, folks. I had cysts. You know, other kids had acne. Guess what mine was? The doctor called it acne vulgaris. That means ugly. He confirmed my suspicions. And I hated those pimples. He used to take my daddy's razor. I've shaved off the side of my face. And mom and dad are being old-fashioned. Said, son, if you do certain things, you're going to have pimples on your face. And I used to say I didn't do them things. The hell I didn't. That was one of the things I was really talented at. I mean, it's all a part of dreamland, you know. And all I had to do was walk down the street. People looked at my face. They knew what I was doing. Like I had a neon sign over my head saying, he's doing it, he's doing it, he's doing it. And that'll make you nervous. And I began to think they were all staring at me and talking about me. And they didn't like me. I got paranoid. Heard a psychiatrist say not long ago, said, you weren't paranoid. They really didn't like you. And he's probably right. Now, you got the picture? Pain. Pain based on frustration, despair, emptiness. I'm 15 years old. And I'm off on a high school singing trip with some older, more experienced men. 17, 18 years old. And we're in a hotel room. And they called the cab driver and gave him $7.50 and sent him out. And he came back with a bottle full of brown fluid. And the label said, Cream of Kentucky. And I said to the wisest of these older men, his name was Egghead Baker. People think I'm lying. That's the truth. That was his name, Egghead Baker. I said, Egghead, what do we do with that stuff? And he said, Tommy, you drink a glass of it fast as you can, and you drink a glass of water fast as you can. You keep on doing that, you're going to feel good. I got to tell you, I went in front of the bathroom mirror and watched myself take my first drink. I'll never forget it. And Egghead Baker lied to me. All of a sudden, I was who I wanted to be, where I wanted to be, doing what I wanted to be doing, and the people around me were just fine, thank you. The emptiness was gone. Everything was mellow. It felt good. That brown fluid did for me what I'd heard in the Baptist church God was supposed to do. Think about that. And right away, it assumed a value to me that you wouldn't believe. And these older, more experienced men passed out. I didn't. When they were passed out, I called a cab driver. I gave him a 7.5, and I got me a pint of Cream of Kentucky. And right away, my mind got locked up on this magic fluid. This stuff that did for me what nothing else had ever done. If you don't understand the value of alcohol to an alcoholic, you'll never understand alcoholism. Tremendously valuable stuff to me. It took precedence over everything in my life. I was willing to give up my self-respect, my freedom, my family, my home, anything for that effect that it produced. And you know what effect it produced? The one Dr. Silkworth talks about. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, he said. You know, there's an English poet named A.E. Houseman. Don't know if any of you read any of his work, but he had to be a drunk. Because he wrote the following poem. Let me share it with you. I didn't even plan to do this. Listen. It goes, ale, man, ale's the stuff to drink for fellows whom it hurts to think. Look into the pewter pot and see the world as the world is not. And faith 'tis present till 'tis past. The mischief is, it will not last. Though I have been to Ludlow Fair and left my necktie God knows where, and carried through my home or near pints and quarts of Ludlow beer. And then the world seemed none so bad, and I myself a sterling lad, and down in lovely muck I've lain, happy, till I woke again. And then I saw the morning sky. Hi-ho, the tale was all a lie. The world, it was the old world yet, and I was I, and my clothes were wet. And nothing now remained to do but begin the game anew. See what I mean? The man had to be a drunk. Blackouts began for me immediately. At the age of 16 and 17, I was being locked up regularly in jail. By the time I was 23 years old, I'd been in psycho wards, religious homes for alcoholics, detox centers. I'd had over 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone as a result of drinking, and I was still telling myself the alcoholic lie. This time it's going to be different. This time if I just handle it right, I'm going to be able to drink like everybody else. I was not willing to give up the thing that was most valuable to me in my life. When I was in the psycho ward, by the way, I wasn't diagnosed as alcoholic. I was diagnosed as manic depressive. I took over that psycho ward. I excelled at being crazy. I went right for the top of the heap. Being an alcoholic, which being translated means being a con man, in 2 weeks the psychiatrist was telling me his troubles. And I loved it there. I was the center of attention. All you had to do was look a little funny. That nurse would grab that needle and come pop you one. And then you could float around for a while. And you had control, see, because you get in there and shave, and there's a guy sitting on the stool watching you. And I used to love to move that razor a little quick and watch that sucker jump. That's real control. And control is one of my problems as an alcoholic. I want to control everything and everybody so I won't be hurt. And I was sick with control. And I used it. And I used people. And I used things. And I used situations and circumstances. I set the stage. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 23. And was up in Raleigh, North Carolina. There's an old boy that was at that meeting. Took him 5 years to get up the nerve to tell me something. He said, "I remember your first meeting." He said, "I took one look at you and immediately punched the guy next to me and said, 'He ain't just an alcoholic. He's crazy as hell.'" And I came in that meeting and the great mind went to work. Okay? And by the way, I'm a memory verse expert in the Baptist Church and the Royal Ambassadors for Christ. See? And there was a plaque over here that had 12 steps and one over here had 12 traditions. Blue book sitting in front of the man up front that everybody was paying attention to. And I said, "Well, all you got to do is memorize those 12 steps and those 12 traditions. Memorize what's in that book. And they'll put you up front and they'll listen to you. Why, you ought to be president of this outfit in 6 months. I'd always done everything that way, right to the top, to gain that control. And so I tried it on AA. I can quote great portions of this book to you. Difference is I don't have to anymore. But I'll tell you something, if you're ever in a discussion meeting with me, don't misquote it. You know what those people did? They put me up front. I delivered some of the windiest dissertations on theosophy and ontology and epistemology that you've ever heard in your life. Only thing I couldn't do was stay sober. For the next 7 years, knowing everything there was to know about this program in an intellectual sense, the longest I ever stayed dry was 89 days. And it wasn't because I didn't want to stay sober. I did. I wasn't trying to be not sober. I was trying to be sober. But I was doing it my way. I knew no other way. And I know it was 89 days that time, because up in North Carolina, we give a red poker chip for 90 days. And I wanted one of them things so bad, sometimes when the meeting was over, I'd been up and stole one. And I'd sit out in my den, you know, and I'd meditate and read the great books of God. St. Augustine, Thomas Kempis, Imitation of Christ, Martin Buber's Iron Thou, Paul Tillich, The Courage to Be. You name them, I read them. Brother Lawrence, all of them. Waiting for my spiritual awakening to happen. See, I'm a Baptist. I know what a spiritual awakening is supposed to be like. I mean, God knocked Paul off a jackass. He lit up a bush for Moses and talked to him. And that's the kind of spiritual awakening I was looking for. A lightning bolt. Don't tell me God ain't got a sense of humor. I can see him now looking at me and say, "Is that dummy again?" Yeah, I'd send him a lightning bolt. Got plenty. But he wouldn't like the color. I used to go to an AA group up in Burlington that was so traditional, everybody had a seat. You ever been to a group that traditional? You don't sit in nobody's seat. That's the way this group was. You go up there next Sunday night, they'll be sitting in them seats. Barney will be leaned up against the wall. Jim S. on the second row, second chair. Fourth row, fourth chair is an empty seat. That's Martha. She's been dead 12 years. And Freeman used to be there. And over on the right-hand side, second row, second chair from the wall, sat the meanest man that God ever made. His name was Bill C. And I called him Grumpy. And I hated his guts. You know why? He always told me the truth. You ever run in one of them old-timers with X-ray vision? I'd walk in the meeting. And Grumpy would say, "How you doing, boy?" Always called me boy and pointed his finger at me. "How you doing, boy?" I'd say, "Fine." He'd say, "Bullshit." And these old timers sit around and dream up these circular sayings to lay on you, you know. I hate them. Used to. Like them now. He'd say them circular sayings to me, like, "Boy, you don't think your way into good living. You live your way into good thinking." I'd think, "Shut up. I'm smarter than you are." And the one that always used to really get me was, "Boy, how come you always run around looking for God? He ain't lost." And I didn't like this old man at all. He read me like a book. And you know, when somebody reads you like a book, you got to get their approval. If you're an alcoholic and he's not on your side, you got to get him. One way or the other. And one Sunday afternoon, I got the opportunity. I got a 12-step call. Jumped on my white charger. Flew down there, found this drunk laid up in a log cabin with no indoor plumbing. Been there 2 months. You can imagine what it looked like. He was turning blue, and that place was unbelievable. And I got him off to a doctor, and got a lady from down the street, and we shoveled out that place. Swept it, mopped it, everything else. I went to the telephone to call Grumpy so he could come see the wonder that I had wrought. And you know, in going through all that stuff in that house, I found a gallon of wine, and when Grumpy got there, I was drunk too. He was not at all impressed. Now, in a way, this talk is for Grumpy, okay? His name was Bill Crumpler. He died last month. And I went to his funeral. And so help me God, when a friend called and told me that he had died, I knew he was going to die. Cancer was eating him up alive. But when the friend called, my first thought was, "Old man, you didn't die. That ain't your style." That's the kind of man he was. And God help us, I hope AA stays full of Bill Crumpler. And I'm going to tell you something else. He ain't dead. Not as long as I'm walking around on 2 feet. People are going to hear about hard-nosed sponsorship, gut-level truth. Because that's what he was. He was quite a man. I didn't think so then. He'd sit over there on Tuesday night discussion meeting, and he'd rattle his chains and pull his nose, had a great old big ugly nose, looked like a pickle, and run his hand through his hair, and he'd rattle his chains and pull his nose and run his hand through his hair and say the same thing every Tuesday night. Now, when he died, he was sober 34 years. And if you're having trouble staying sober, by God, rattle your chains. And that used to just blow my mind. And I'd go to meetings with all this heavy knowledge to lay on the troops. Any of y'all ever do that? Sitting there with your knuckles white, waiting your turn to come? Don't lie to me. We've all done it. Any discussion meeting's like a game of can you top this, and you know it and I know it. And they'd go around that room and they'd get to me last. They always got to me last. I used to wonder about that, I understand. And I'd say, "Paul Tillich said so-and-so, and Martin Buber said so-and-so." And Grumpy turned around and said, "Shut up, boy." And I'd go get drunk at him. I had the best help available to a human being. I did. The best help available. I called Grumpy one night and I was drunk. I was always drunk when I called. That's when I called for help. When it was impossible. And before I could say a word, he said, "Boy, don't you ever call me again drunk." He said, "Matter of fact, don't you ever call me again." He said, "If you want to get sober, you know where we meet. And don't call me to come get you. As far as I'm concerned, you can walk." And he said, "Frankly, Tom, I don't give a damn if you ever get sober or not." That hurt my feelings. And you know, that's one of the most loving things that any human being ever did for me in my entire life. He pulled out the stops. He let me know he would not be used anymore. He knew that I wasn't ready. And I wasn't. I drank on. 7 years after I was introduced to AA, it was the most horrible drinking in my life because I knew there was an answer. And I was that close to the switch and I couldn't reach it. And I knew all the directions. Just seemed I couldn't follow. You got people in your group like that? For God's sake, be gentle with them. Reach a hand out and put it on theirs, you know. You might reach the switch. Now, I drank on till I was 30 years old. And I came to on or about July 20th, 1965. And I knew three things real clear. They came to my mind with a clarity that they had never come before. And the first was, "Tom, you can't drink." And the second one was, "And you can't quit." How many times have you been on a 12-step call and the man said, "I know I can't drink"? Did you ever feel like saying to him, "Did you know you can't quit either?" And the third idea was, "You're going to die." Now, by this time, I'm on 5 years probation. I have no driver's license. And God made a profit out of Grumpy. I walked back to AA. And I went to meetings and I sat on the back row and I got there late and I left early. I didn't want anything to do with those people. I just didn't want to die. But I kept going. Grumpy was to tell me later, "The only thing you ever did right, boy, was you kept coming back." And I did. And I got hanging around there and I got to watching this one man in the group and he had good eyes. You want to see a sober alcoholic, look at eyes. Look at him. Look at that bright coming out of his eyes. You want to see one sober up? Watch the bloodshot disappear and the jumping stop and the quivering stop and that magic something starts coming out of his eyes. He doesn't even know it's there, but you do. That's sobriety. It's also the God that dwells within us. This man had good eyes. And I said to him, I want to stay sober. Will you be my sponsor? And you know what he said to me? He said, boy, I have heard about you. They tell me you're crazy. But he said, I'll sponsor you on one condition. And I said, what's that? He said, we'll do it my way. And I said, yes, sir. Please. And he said, the first thing I want you to do is go to meetings early. I want you to go in and shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing. I said, that doesn't have anything to do with anything. I don't want to go early. I don't want to shake anybody's hand. Don't care how they're doing. And why do I have to do that? And he said, boy, you don't ask me why. You do it. And by God, I did it. And it was something. It must have been laughable. I'd go in and see, I looked at shoe tops. I didn't look at people. I looked left, right, up, down, anywhere. Because I afraid if I looked at you, you'd see inside me what was really there. So I'm looking at shoe tops and I shake hands. After a few weeks, I was seeing some ankles. A few more weeks, my voice is clearing up a little bit and I'm seeing some shins. A few more weeks, I saw some hips. Some of the nicest hips I ever saw. In a few more weeks, I was looking them in the eye, and I was glad to see them, and I did care how they were doing, and I knew that they felt the same way about me. God, it was magic. The way my sponsor taught me what love was magic. And I know today, see, love's not a feeling. Feelings come, and feelings go, and feelings change. Love stays. Love is God's pure action in this universe, and it goes from me to you, to you, to you, to him, to you, to you. You ever hear the old Baptist song? May the circle be unbroken. That's love. And he taught me that. And he had sense enough not to go to dictionary. Okay? I started getting sober. And he started working me through those steps. I took the third step. And I was so afraid that it wasn't going to work that I read it out of the book over and over to myself, Jim, I don't know how many times. I didn't want to miss a jot or a tittle. I did not want ever to drink again. And I changed. I turned, folks. I was reborn. And I started off in a newborn, new direction, a newborn baby. Okay? New life. And I didn't have to worry about where I was going at night. That Lincoln Continental pull up in front of my house and that cigar would wave out the window like that. I was going to an AA meeting. I didn't have to worry where I was going at 3 o'clock in the morning. Phone rang. You going with me on a 12-step call. First one I went on, I ran in there. I was ready to save a soul. I said, what did I say, eh? He said, you don't know nothing. You don't say nothing. Sit down and shut up. He told me when I could talk. He told me when to sit down. That cigar would wave and I'd sit. And I got feeling so good I couldn't hardly stand. I was sitting up to college where I worked one day eating my bag lunch, and all of a sudden one of the greatest thoughts I ever had in my life came to me. And it was this. Hey, you haven't wanted a drink for over 3 months. Can you imagine that? And I cried like a baby. And chill bumps broke out all over. Never had such feeling. Never. And we went along and he taught and I learned. He's a great teacher, my sponsor. And I began to be remade, regenerated. I got a boy at home, he's 14, named Jason. You ever want to really learn something profound? Listen to children. See, we adults don't know anything profound. Children do. And this boy's always amazed me with what he would tell me. And we're sitting on the couch one night, and he says, Dad, why don't I be the dad for a while, and you be the son? And I said, how are we going to work that out, boy? He said, it's easy. I'll grow up and be the father. You grow down and be the son. You know, I've never heard a better description of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my whole life than growing down to assume your rightful position as a child of God. So help me. And it did. Now, I've been sober a long time. I haven't lived a bowl of cherries. I've had bottoms beyond bottoms. I've gone through stages of sobriety. I went through the stage of sobriety 1 to 2 to 3 years, you know, where I knew it all. I wondered why anybody would ask anybody else anything as long as I was there. I wondered why everybody didn't ask me to be their sponsor. I second-guessed all the old-timers. I was sure that even though they'd been sober 30 years, the quality of my sobriety was better. I was an arrogant ass of the first degree. And thank God again for the old-timers, who often, I couldn't understand as good as I was doing, often put me in the corner and said, "Boy, who the hell you think you are? Who taught you so much? You Bill Wilson?" And bring me down there. I went through other stages. Lots of them. I went through 5-year menopause. That's what we call it up in North Carolina. That's when you've both been sober 5 years and you look around and the world's still gray or brown, whichever way you look at it. And nothing's changed and everything seems kind of flat and meaningless, you know. And you say, what's going on here? You know, I've seen so many people get sober at 5 years of sobriety that I can't count them. 5-year menopause. And I think that that is the point that I really joined AA in the sense of doing something deeply about being myself and finding myself and doing something for others. It was a great growth spurt for me. And I've told many people along about that stage since. When they come in and they got that feeling, that flat feeling, despair, you know, they're not going anywhere. Nothing good is happening to them. Why don't you join AA? And they look at me funny. See, there's something about we alcoholics that we got to know, and I'm using the word we. We don't know how to eat Oreos. Did you know that? Alcoholics goes right for that creamy center. We pull the wafers apart and go right for that creamy center. You know? Shrinks call it delay of gratification. I call it we don't know how to eat Oreos. You know, we get sober on Tuesday. We expect the wife to turn into Lana Turner by Thursday and God to fill up with the goody truck by Friday and there to be a deacon the next Sunday. We're funny people. You know that? We are strange. We got to learn how to eat Oreos. I did. I had to learn discipline. Disciplined prayer, disciplined meditation, disciplined practice of this program. The bottom line in the spiritual life to me is not faith or hope or charity. It's practice. You can know everything in this program, and if you don't do it, it don't mean nothing. Practice, practice, practice. My sponsor told me that. Effort, result, effort, result. God, I got tired of hearing that. But he's right. And then I got into a stage in my life where my sexuality expressed itself. And I've got to share you with this with you, you know. Do you know, according to mythology, when we got here, we was all in one piece. Do you know that? And the gods got worried about that and said, if we leave them like that, they're going to become like us. So the gods split us in half. Read any creation story and you'll find it there. They split us in half. And ever since, one of the deepest longings, one of the biggest needs of every human being is the need to be whole. All in one piece. And there are two great thirsts that are in every human being. And the one thirst is a thirst for union with Almighty God, and that's called spirituality. And the other is thirst for union with another human being, and that is called sexuality. And I've seen a lot of people confuse the two. When sexuality is sanctified by spirituality, it's a grand and a glorious and a beautiful thing. But when sexuality takes precedence over spirituality, you're going straight into the gates of perdition. And it's hard to tell the difference sometimes. This is the reason our old-timers say men ought to sponsor men and women ought to sponsor women, because it is awfully hard for spirituality to be aroused without sexuality being aroused at the same time. The source of them seems to be very close. And what happened to me was, I fell in love. My wife wasn't good enough for me anymore. I needed something more beautiful. I prayed. Be very careful about that, folks. And one night, the most gorgeous redhead you've ever seen in your life walked into my office at the college and made her intentions known. So help me God. I have never suffered like that in my entire life. Because sexuality took precedence. She went into the center of my life where I knew God had to be. I overcompensated in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sponsoring everybody. I was speaking everywhere. It was coming out of my guilt. I had to somehow make up for what I knew I was doing wrong. I left home and I went back home and I left home and I went back home. Lust pulled me out, guilt pulled me back. And in all those automobile wrecks that I'd had while I was drinking, I got a bunch of scar tissue up here in my head. I'm a sap, a sucker for a migraine headache, and I started having them. That's the way I punished myself. And for those migraine headaches, the doctor had to zap me with Demerol mixed with Compazine or mixed with Valium. And that's the only thing that would stop them. And I went to a psychologist and I went to a psychiatrist, you see, trying to find an answer. What I was trying to find was justification. I knew what was wrong with me, and I couldn't let it go. I was as obsessed with this person as I had been with booze. I was willing to give up my self-respect, my freedom, my family, my home, my job, and almost my life. And then it got to a point I knew it was going to kill me. And I went to a friend in AA, and I said, I got to do something. And he says, tell me, next time she calls, you hang up the phone and come on over here. I said, what are we going to do? And he said, I don't know. And she called, and I hung up the phone, and I ran to his house, and he met me at the door, and I busted into tears, and he busted into tears, and you Al-Anons ain't the only ones that know what letting go is like, because for the next 3 weeks, we cried. And I let go. And the obsession's gone. But I've learned a great deal about the power that's involved in sexuality and spirituality. And I'll tell you, alcoholics, once you go from booze to pills, the next move is sick sex. You know it, and I know it. And the ABCs in this program says no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and yet we try to put God-like attributes on another human being and demand of them to do what only God can do. And when they can't cut it, we pass them off and go to another one. And we've gotten our thirst for union with God mixed up with another thirst. And I lived through that. And I learned from that. Now, I'm not ugly anymore. I'm not insane. And I don't hate my guts. And me and my mother are the best of friends. And she never did hate me. She used to dominate me. You know why? Because I demanded domination. I'm changed. Now, am I changed because I am so brilliant? No. Because I'm so good? No, because I'm not. I'm changed because this program has done for me precisely what it said it would do. Precisely. Okay? My own father is the best man I've ever known in my life. God, he was beautiful. A quiet, gentle, loving, kind man. Really good one, Jim. My daddy would come down to my house. Every kid in the neighborhood and every dog in the neighborhood would be there in 5 minutes. He loved him. And I loved him. And he adored me. And when I was 18 years old, he was taking me down to the bus to leave for the Air Force so I wouldn't have to go to jail. And while he was telling me how much he loved me, he had his hand firmly planted on my butt, pushing me up the steps of that bus. I was about to drive him crazy. And a few years ago, I had the opportunity to be with him as he died over about a 6-week period. And I learned about strength. And I learned about faith. And the morning before he died, he rolled over. He says, am I going to die? I said, yes, sir. Does that frighten you? This man's not an alcoholic, folks. He said, yeah, it frightens me. But I figure when you get frightened, all you have to do is just turn the fear over to God and go on about your business. And then he said something that I'll never forget. He said, Tommy, I love you. You are one of the finest men I have ever known. Quite a change. Quite a change. And people wonder why I'm enthusiastic about this program. And why I love it so much. How could I feel otherwise? You see, I have a purpose in my life. His meaning in my life. I think often of Robert Frost's line of poetry because it fits me now. I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep.
miles to go before I sleep. And I have a love affair going with my family. And I have a love affair going with God. And I have a love affair going with life. And I have a love affair going with you all. I really do. I'm not just saying that. I don't believe in just saying love. There's a boy up in North Carolina named James Taylor, writes music. Any of you familiar with him? He often writes songs that have double meanings. And I can describe my love affairs with a song of his, which might surprise you. It means an awful lot to me. And it goes this way. I needed the shelter of someone's arms, and there you were. I needed someone to understand my ups and downs, and there you were, with sweet love and devotion, deeply touching my emotions. I gotta stop and thank you, baby. I just gotta stop and thank you. Yes, I do. How sweet it is to be loved by you. I close my eyes at night wondering where would I be without you in my life. Everything I did was such a bore. Everywhere I went, it seemed I'd been there before. But you brighten up for me all of my days. With love so sweet in so many ways. I gotta stop and thank you, baby. I just gotta stop and thank you. How sweet it is to be loved by you. And this, it really is. I'm a twice-born man. I'm the son of the most powerful, loving force in this universe. And all I have to do is let God be God and me be me. And I am certain that I will be happy and joyous and free. I don't think that. I'm certain of it. Thank you.
Wasn't that good?